The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Pope Francis has no qualms in choosing most of cardinals from countries where Christians are a minority. For example, two come from India, one being Monsignor Anthony Poole, who belongs to the lowest caste. Another new cardinal is a 47-year-old Italian missionary in Mongolia, a country where Christians are a minority. Paraguay will have its first cardinal, and Africa will gain two, one from Nigeria and the other from Ghana, where 10% of the population is Catholic.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, it was some big news, huh? Not one, not 10, not 15, but 21 new cardinals. On Sunday, right after he prayed the Regina Coeli, Pope Francis announced that he has appointed 21 bishops from around the world to the College of Cardinals. I saw a report somewhere. I don't have the data in front of me, but based on his papacy right now, I mean, he has beatified and canonized more saints than even John Paul II, who had a really long term. Isn't that fascinating? The reason he gets in under that window is because he canonized the martyrs of Otranto, 800 at one time. So, in terms of the College of Cardinals, 66%. Now have come from the appointments of Pope Francis. The only Americans among them is Bishop Robert McElroy of San Diego, which is a surprise since San Diego, like Newark and New Jersey, it's really not a cardinal sea. I don't remember the word cardinal. I forget the word. There's a particular word for the sea of cardinals, and that's not one of those. But the consistory for official elevation won't be until August 27th. And if you're planning to go, just remember that most Romans leave the city for the month. It gets pretty hot, in Rome at that point in time. So, President Biden is also making some news. We'll see how this plays out. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen here, but he's expected to announce his plan for canceling some student loan debt. I don't know if you're still carrying it or not. Maybe your kids are saddled with it, private loans and government loans, federal loans. Some believe the amount's going to be $10,000 to anyone who's making under $150,000 a year. So $10,000 is that's a lot of money. It's a lot of student loan payments. Let's put it that way. So if you're making less than $150,000, it looks like that's going to happen. All told, it's going to amount to about $230 billion. And he's doing this. Some experts are saying right now he's doing this because his poll numbers, they keep sinking, right? And the midterms are right around the corner right now, and they look tough. It was a campaign promise that he had put out as well. So, I saw interviews with people saying, hey, look, one of the reasons I voted for the Biden administration was because he had promised to, pay off some of these student loans. It hasn't happened yet. So I think that's one of the reasons that we may see it happen. They want to make sure that they, continue to get some of those votes. And I think he also wants to honor that campaign promise. Reaction to it has been varied. The NAACP, the president there, Derek Johnson, was saying that, look, 10 grand, it's not nearly enough, since black borrowers have an average of $52,000 in loans, which is more debt than what the average white borrower holds, right? Mitch Daniels, the president of Purdue University, the former head of the Office of Management and Budget, he came out and he says, the plan is just fatally flawed. So you've got two different perspectives, two different ends. A lot of people are torn on the issue. It helps a specific sliver of the population, but you are talking about a lot of Americans still, and $10,000 to lighten the load, I'm sure. And I was reading a report over the weekend of people, what they would do and how they feel about it. And some people who have student loans say, hey, I'd love it, but I don't feel right about it, but they're not going to say no to it. And others are saying, hey, look, I paid off my loans. Others are saying, you took the loan, you knew the consequences, now you got to pay it back. It's not fair. But we'll see whether or not it happens. I still, I'll believe it when the ink is dry, I guess, right? But that's the word right now. $10,000 if you make less than $150,000, it's going to be $230 billion in terms of money that's going to be spread out. So we'll see what happens. Look, we've been following these stories. I'm going to ask you to pray for this. And I've been on top of the story in Katy, Texas. Remember that, where the thieves stole the tabernacle. In Brooklyn, New York, thieves broke into St. Augustine's Church in Park Slope area on Friday, and they used power tools to cut out a tabernacle that dates all the way back to 1895. This thing was valued. They estimated it being around $2 million. You believe that? It was made out of 18-karat gold. That's probably why gold is way up. A $2 million tabernacle. It's pretty cool. I think the Lord deserves certainly that, right? And it's a beautiful piece of art. I don't know if you had a chance to see any of the images of this. But unlike that situation in Katy, it looks like the thieves were after the gold, not just the most precious, you know, body and blood of our Lord. The hosts were strewn all over the altar of the sanctuary. Two statues of angels on either side of the tabernacle were decapitated, too. So police are continuing to investigate. But, you know, when I heard about the story and I thought, you know, churches are pretty easy targets. I mean, I don't think they have high security in them, right? And if you have a tabernacle like this made of gold, or you have chalices, or you have other things in the venue, and part of me doesn't even want to mention this on the air. I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but they seem like they're pretty easy targets. I wonder if things are going to change, and maybe it is a wake-up call to pastors who are listening right now. You might want to consider the security at your church and how you're going to keep not just the Lord safe, but, you know, the contents of your church. But that tabernacle there, as tragic as it is, it was a theft for money. The pro-lifers, did you hear about this one? A pro-life center in Seattle, it underwent an ideological attack last week. Next Step Pregnancy Center, it was splashed with red paint and had at least five windows smashed in. Security camera at this pregnancy center in Linwood, Washington, caught what was a lone vandal smashing several windows and spray painting very threatening messages. Here's a little bit more from the local news there.
Cleanup is still going on over at Next Step Pregnancy Services Center in Linwood. That's after someone smashed several windows and spray-painted threatening messages. It all happened early Wednesday morning. One of the messages read, "If abortion isn't safe, you aren't either." The center's executive director called the incident disheartening, and she believes the vandals confused about what goes on inside that center.
We're here every day, all day, doing what we do, and I just think they're confused about what really happens here. And so I think they're, yeah, just misinformed, and I wish that they would kind of come in, spend time with us, ask us what we really do.
The estimated cost to repair the damage is over $5,000. Linwood police are investigating, and the FBI has been made aware of the incident.
Yeah, to her point, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. People see something that's pro-life, and their mind is made up. That center in particular, Next Step, it provides free pregnancy center test, pregnancy testing, right? If you think you're pregnant, you can go in and get tested, right? Ultrasounds, you can get counseled. They help any woman who's made the mistake of abortion. They got some post-abortion support there, and maybe you lost a child through miscarriage. They have pregnancy loss support. They have adoption information. They do a lot of good. And again, you go back to that slogan that, you know, when it comes to abortion, if abortion's not safe, then you're not safe. I mean, it's ridiculous is really what it is. But again, it's all rooted in violence, isn't it? That's what this all comes down to. California lawmakers surprisingly made a change to a bill that the Catholic Conference in that state brought to the attention of the bill's author. And this is another story we've been talking about. And I just want to make sure that my T's are crossed and my I's are dotted here, and I want you to be aware of what's happening. This is good, okay? The bill's intent, remember that one? The story about being able to terminate a child up to 2 months. Well, this California is, again, I want to credit the Catholic Conference in the state. They brought the attention to whoever wrote the bill. And the bill's intent is that a woman is not charged with a crime if they miscarriage. But the bill had that language in it that it made sound like no one would be charged if an infant died through starvation or by other means. And so how do you translate that? What does that mean? Well, through infanticide, right? The child's born, and no one's going to be charged if you starve to death, right, or some sort of other means. So media fact checkers claim that that's not what the bill did, but the author went ahead and changed the language anyway to make it clear that's not what she meant. So you will not be seeing legalized infanticide in California. So bravo. That's good news, right? Because the way those two bills read, both in Maryland and California, that was the case. And somebody could have used that as a cloak or a blanket, a protection. Look, this is still pending. There's a bill right now in Maryland that's still pending where it could happen, right? Where it can be used like that. Looks like, looks like we're seeing right now the end of pro-life elected Democrats. So we'll see how everything changes when it comes to life now, too, because I saw an Axios analysis in 1976. I think you'll find this fascinating when it comes to this life issue here. 1976, the Hyde Amendment, it banned federal funding for most abortions, right? It passed the House. Check this number out. 247 Democratic votes. 247 Democratic votes. That's 1976, right? Our bicentennial year. Just 22 Democrats at the time voted no and 16 didn't vote. Today, just to give you a perspective on the party and where their head is, where their ideology is, what they worship, what they hold high and holy. Today, there is only one, I repeat, one pro-life Democrat in the House. That's it. He's in Texas. Henry Cuellar of Texas. And guess what? Just like Congressman Lipinski, right? He's being primaried. Can you believe that? The Democratic Party is going to primary this guy. We can't have anybody that's for life. We just can't have it in our party. You know, a child doesn't deserve to live. Right? I mean, that's the mindset. So this guy's outgunned now, outnumbered. He's going to be primaried. In the Senate, there's also only one pro-life Democrat. Guess who that is? You probably can guess, right? Joe Manchin, right? It's just crazy. It's absolutely nuts where it is. Please say a prayer. I joined the Holy Father today at 11 o'clock, and I prayed for peace in Ukraine and in Russia and in the world. And I prayed for our country and our leaders. Let's continue to pray for. We need two parties, right? We don't. We shouldn't be arguing and debating and, you know, having to look at who we put in office just through the filter of life. That's the top of the pyramid. Would it be nice to look at other issues, you know, economy and social justice and a lot of other things? Unfortunately, you can't. You really can't. You can't. Those are all secondary. You don't have a right to health care. You don't have a right to Social Security. You don't have a right to carry a gun. You don't have a right to anything if you don't have a right to life, right? You just don't. So that's got to be the top. And it's the moral. It's really a moral way of voting. I would love to see pro-life Democrats. I'd love to see pro-life Republicans, and I'd like then to look at the morality of the issues that will better advance the common good of this country. I want to share with you something else. I do want to talk about Nancy Pelosi, speaking of communion and elected officials, right? Speaker of the House, as you know, because we had His Excellency Archbishop Cordiglione on the air talking about how she was not allowed to receive communion in his diocese. Well, that began to spread from diocese to diocese. And let me just share with you what Bishop Michael Burbridge from the Diocese of Arlington has decided to do. Burbridge, I should say. He decided to respect Archbishop Cordiglione on the communion ban towards Nancy Pelosi, and he has extended it to his diocese in Virginia as well. So take a listen. Again, my hat off to the Archdiocese of Arlington, to Bishop Burbridge. Take a listen to this conversation from Bishop Burbridge's Walk Humbly podcast. Check it out.
Given that we're on the border of Washington, D.C., we've been asked via social media and otherwise if you would uphold Archbishop Corleone's decision should Speaker Pelosi attend Mass in our diocese. What would be your response to that?
Well, in short, yes, I would. I would respect. He is her bishop. And as that bishop, the direction and guidance he provides is not limited to just a geographical area. Mm. So in short, yes, I would respect the decision of Archbishop Cordiglione and be consistent with that decision here in the Diocese of Arlington should that situation occur.
Okay.
These matters, although it doesn't seem that way sometimes, these are not political for bishops. They're moral. And they're spiritual, and they're a result of prayer and discernment. And again, I can't say it enough. Decisions are made for the good of the individuals to guard the faithful from scandal. Because you know, there is scandal when people in high offices like this not only take a position that is so contrary to the church, but they connect it to their faith.
Yeah, that's when people feel particularly offended.
Well, that's so wrong. And that is even, you know, of even greater concern. And that confuses people. Yes. And a bishop has to guard against that. That's the goal. It's not to punish someone or to keep them from the sacraments. Speaker Pelosi and all of us are always given that chance, that opportunity to be reconciled. And she has that path to reunite with our Lord in the Eucharist. And then she has to discern if she's willing to accept that.
Say a prayer for her. She's your sister, right? Nancy Pelosi is your sister in Christ, and it's really about her soul. And I love what Bishop Burbridge said. He says, look, this is not political. The world only sees things through the political lens, right, through the temporal. It's about the moral. Here's what else he said. Let me just share one quote. He says, I support Archbishop Cordiglione in the heroic and compassionate stance he took today in the protection and the defense of human life. As Pope Francis said, every child who, rather than being born, is condemned unjustly to being aborted, bears the face of Jesus Christ. He bears the face of the Lord who experienced the world's rejection. We love the children in the womb, and we love the child's mother. Two others, just as a side note, have not only stated that they support him, but they also said that the speaker cannot receive communion in their diocese either. And that's Bishop Vasha of Santa Rosa and at border San Francisco to the north. And she can't receive there since she has a vacation home in Napa. So that area is now off grounds. So, who's the other one? Santa Rosa, which borders San Francisco. And there's one other bishop, too. Arlington, I have. And then I guess Cordiglione. But anyway, you know what? J.D. Flynn, who's the co-founder and editor-in-chief for The Pillar, joins me today. They've been reporting on this. I want to get his take on the latest when it comes to Nancy Pelosi and this extended and expanding ban. J.D., it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, Drew. How you doing?
I'm well. Hey, how many dioceses has she been banned in now? You know, and again, and we can talk about that, but I mean, am I missing one here? Is it much larger? Are more bishops coming on board?
Yeah, so Religion News Service reported last week that in addition to Archbishop Cordiglione, Bishop Robert Vasa in the Diocese of Santa Rosa, where Pelosi has a vacation home, and Bishop Michael Burbidge in the Diocese of Arlington, who we just heard from, and then also Bishop Strickland in the Diocese of Tyler, Texas. Now, I'm not sure that Nancy Pelosi is a frequent visitor to Tyler, Texas, but should she have some reason to go there, I guess Bishop Strickland just wanted to clarify that.
Has there been any reaction from Nancy on this? I know you guys have been following this pretty closely. I don't know if it bothers her or not. I don't know whether she'll just go to some other place, but what's been the overall reaction to this? There doesn't seem to be any mea culpa coming from her.
Yeah, you know, Pelosi, I think last weekend and some of the weekend shows, pushed back on her own Archbishop Cordiglione a little bit, saying effectively, from her perspective, the Archbishop had kind of singled her out, that he hadn't prohibited people from Holy Communion who advocate for the unjust use of the death penalty, which the church is also against the unjust application of the death penalty, and that, she said there was a sort of unfairness there. And she said, we have to be prayerful about it, we have to be respectful, but she was definitely kind of pushing back and picking up this narrative that you've seen advanced in other places, that Archbishop Cordiglione's decision on this was selective or arbitrary or political or something like that.
I wonder how long she'll hold out. I think eventually, I hope eventually, she comes around, but really tragic. You know, your vacation home, your own diocese, now Arlington, now Texas. I was hoping even more bishops would come on board. We'll have to see what happens.
No, just that a number of dioceses have not sort of said what they'll do, you know, if Nancy Pelosi comes to the diocese or something like that. But a number of bishops, I want to say about a dozen bishops, have just put out statements kind of affirming Archbishop Cordiglione's decision on this and saying that they think it was the right decision and that, you know, they respect and these kinds of things. So, you know, I do think that there's been a bit more supportive than that. And I suspect if it, you know, depending on sort of which way this goes, there may be other bishops who sort of affirm that as well.
Now, you're a canon lawyer, so let me ask you, could Archbishop Cordiglione have excommunicated her? He could have, I would assume, or maybe not. Answer that first, and then I want to follow up, because I think there might be a strategy to what he's doing here.
Well, there is an argument that because Speaker Pelosi has consistently defied the teaching of the church with regard to abortion, that because she said things like abortion is a sacred right, you know, mm-hmm. which would seem to fly in the face of the church's teaching about the inviolability of human life, that because she said those things, that Archbishop Cordiglione could, in theory, consider whether to declare a penalty of excommunication for the crime of heresy, that her statements on abortion could be considered to be sort of tantamount to heresy on the issue. And I know that there are, you know, canon lawyers mm-hmm. who support that idea and support that theory. That's not what he's done thus far. Excommunication is a kind of defined penalty in the church, but, you know, at least that, and it's not something that's sort of happened before, so no one would quite, you know, it'd be novel and it would be worth sort of watching what happened next. But there is at least been the argument that he could make that move if he chose to.
But in order to have the excommunication lifted, what does she have to do? Does she have to appeal? Or does she have to go to Rome, to the Pope himself?
I mean, ideally, the excommunication would be lifted in such a case because a person who committed a canonical crime, you know, recanted their canonical crime, in which case it would be lifted. So that would be, you know, the ideal situation. But yeah, it could be the case that if he had formally declared a penalty, then she could make a kind of an appeal called a recourse to Rome about it, to the Congregation for Bishops, and then the apostolic signature about it. So there would be, it'd be interesting to see whether she did that or whether she just sort of took it as it were. Again, excommunication has the character of universality, so it would apply more directly or concretely in like the Archdiocese of Washington and things like that. But I don't think we know whether or not it would be upheld in other places, or other places would sort of quietly, you know, decline to uphold it. So that's why I think there'd be would open a big can of worms, and it would be very interesting to see sort of what happened next.
And to my point, that's really what I think is happening. I thought it was strategic of Archbishop Cordiglione not to excommunicate it, because you're right. Would it be upheld? I mean, it would be applied universally. But then if it wasn't upheld, you know, it almost gives her, you know, a position. And when you're excommunicated, you can't receive any of the sacraments. You can't go to confession. So I think very pastorally and charitably, he gave her this reprimand. And is inviting her to return, to repudiate, or to, you know, amend her ways, to go ahead and make clear the record and to get to confession. So pretty simple, pretty straightforward, and I think it's very pastoral. You know, I don't want to get too inside baseball, but I'll take a question or two here, too. I'll take a few calls. But there's a term that was thrown around that I'm not familiar with. What's the difference between something that's called an interdiction and excommunication? I understand excommunication. What's an interdiction?
Well, an interdict is a different kind of a penalty. It has some of the same implications, and it could have sacramental implications, but it's effectively a different kind of a canonical penalty, which can which can impede people from participating in the sacraments in much the same way, but it doesn't have some of the same impact on sort of the power of governance or other elements of an excommunication. So it is kind of a technical distinction. In this case, perhaps it would be a distinction without a difference, but it's a similar kind of penalty, though not the same.
Well, let me grab a quick call. We're getting close to a break here. Sandra in Chicago. Good afternoon. You're on the air with J.D. Flynn.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm so happy that Pelosi has been denied from a few more bishops' communion. Her and Joe Biden are walking scandals and embarrassments to the Democratic Party, which, thank God, I'm not a Democrat anymore, but a terrible, a horrible embarrassment to Catholicism. Also, I'm born and raised in Chicago, and my parents immigrated from a communist country, Croatia. And let me just say, I'm extremely embarrassed for my own mayor, Lori Lightfoot, who, when Ella French was killed, murdered last summer, she went to Catholic Church and she took communion. She is a homosexual, and she is in a homosexual marriage, whatever that is, and the priest of the bishop should never have. We need to be a little bit more, these priests need to be a little bit more courageous about who they're giving communion to, these politicians. I don't care. I understand that it's hard to tell for people if you went to confession this morning, but these people...
Sandra, I'm up against the clock. Hold that thought for a second. Shady, I want you to respond to that. You clearly hear the passion there, and You're right. If somebody is, you know, demonstrating public scandal and they're living in a lifestyle, they should not be receiving communion. But I'll let you address that, JD.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's true. It is true that the church teaches that a person who's living a life of public scandal should not be receiving communion. I would offer the reminder that the reason for that, the reason why the church says a person, you know, in a sort of manifest state of grave sin should not be receiving communion is as a sign of the call to conversion for all of us. So all of us are called, and I would just offer this as, I suppose, a counsel, a spiritual counsel. All of us are called in a situation like this, you know, when someone is denied communion, to really examine our own consciences and ask ourselves in humility and ask the Lord in humility to reveal the places where we are in need of conversion and when we're in need of a call, you know, for God's mercy and for God's grace in our own lives. Because, of course, we're all called to be saints, and I think it's helpful to remember that, but by grace, you know, none of us would be living anywhere close to in the way that the Lord has planned for us.
You know, it's such a great point, and I say that all the time. I don't rejoice in the fact that Nancy Pelosi, you know, cannot receive communion. I will rejoice when she amends her life, and you're right. It's not just Nancy. It's not just Joe. It's not just, you know, any other, you know, high-profile figure. It's you and I. I mean, none of us can receive the Lord unworthily. And I think this revitalization of the Eucharist, this year that we're now entering into, this next couple of years the USCCB is going to lead us through, I think it's important to get this issue right. And maybe these people will come to a deeper understanding of really what that truth is.
Yeah.
Hey, JD, thank you for being here with me. Really great to have you.
Sure.
Always good. Check out JD Flynn and check out The Pillar. He's the co-founder, editor-in-chief there. And you can find out more. It's pillarcatholic.com. I'm a subscriber. I think you'll find value in it. Pillarcatholic.com. You can also follow JD on Twitter at JD Flynn. Stay with me. I'll be back with more right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Long COVID is not our first run-in with post-infection syndromes, which means it can be helpful to look at them as a whole. The more we understand post-infection syndromes, the more we can help people with both long COVID and everybody else.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, you know, we've talked a lot about COVID over the past 2 years, and I was hoping it would be behind us. I don't know if you're dealing with long COVID or you know somebody who is. I wonder, and this is just a personal perspective of mine, you know, when you're in your own little sphere, you see things a little bit differently than maybe the big view. Are we seeing a resurgence of COVID? And the reason I ask that, I cannot tell you how many people over the past 5 days that I ran into that are not feeling well and that actually have COVID. Kathy and I, my wife and I, were going to attend a wedding this coming weekend. So we had to drop our dog off at a friend who's going to be watching the dog while we're gone. Scout's going to go to their place. And we dropped the dog off. The person came up and says, "Oh, my gosh, you know, I can't believe this. My son came down with COVID. You know, he is so sick. You know, he woke up, he said he wasn't feeling good, wasn't going to go to work, his throat got all sore." And, well, he and we were all at the cabin, she said, and they slept head to head, and now the brother's sick, so two of them are sick. And now the father got sick. He has this big meeting with all these out-of-town clients coming in, you know, and they're coming in from out of country, and he's got to attend now via Zoom. They're all down. A couple of people that I know that work in the radio industry, one guy says, "You know, I don't feel so good today. I must have been something I ate, right? I feel terrible, right?" Somebody else says, "Oh, it must be my allergies. I'm going to call out sick today. I really feel lethargic and I'm feeling so great." I mean, you might be encountering the same thing. What's going on in the country right now? Are we seeing a resurgence? We talked about maybe a new variant that is rising. I think for the vast majority of Americans, though, I'm sure you feel the way I do. I just want to be done, don't you? Just want to be done with COVID. I don't want to hear the word COVID. I want to move on. Unfortunately, I don't think COVID wants to be done with us. There are two problems that we're facing right now. The first is that there are people who have been fully vaccinated and boosted, but who are ending up with what they call long COVID. And what's long COVID? It's having the symptoms of COVID for a really long time. Maybe you're totally fatigued. Maybe you're not back to yourself yet. Maybe you've lost that sense of smell. The second, according to the Associated Press, is that the coronavirus mutant that is now dominant here in our country, it's a member of the Omicron family, right? So scientists say that, remember how fast Omicron spread? That really hit the country right around Christmas, right after Christmas. It seemed like everybody got sick at that point in time. It's this new mutant. It spreads faster than its Omicron predecessor. And supposedly it's adept at escaping immunity and might actually cause more serious disease. And I don't want to scare you. I just want you to be in the know. I want you to know what's going on here is, you know, you're going to be hanging out with a lot of people, maybe over the holiday, the weekend you did, you know. Apparently what we're seeing here, this new variant combines elements of both the Omicron and the Delta variations. And this variation is called BA.2.1.2.1, and it's responsible, they say, for about 58% of the U.S. COVID cases last week, 58% of them. So on long COVID, the Department of Veteran Affairs did a study. They found that almost 34,000 vaccinated people had breakthrough infections in 2021, and they found that the shots only cut the likelihood of long COVID about 15%. Plus, researchers examining patients for up to 6 months after testing positive, they didn't find a difference in the severity or the range of the symptoms between those who have been vaccinated and those who have not been vaccinated. So the risk of long COVID, it's higher in people with breakthrough infections because, you know, let me rephrase that. I should say the risk of this is higher with breakthrough infections than people with seasonal influenza. Dr. Tabali joins the study. We'll take your calls, too. If you have a question, feel free to dial in. If you're going through this and you want some advice, the number is 888-914-9149. Dr. Tabali, as you know, practices adult and pediatric infectious disease in the great suburbs of Chicago, and he joins us today. Hey, Dr. Tabali, thank you for your time again. I value it, and I know how precious it is, so thanks for being here.
Yeah, so, Drew, this COVID is a big, sticky tar pit that we've fallen into, and I don't know when we're going to get out of it anytime soon. We have diversions like monkeypox, but this COVID's going to be with us, you know, for as long as we can see into the future, variations of it. So,
that's not good.
I don't
news.
Think it's going to be as bad, but yeah. But, you know, it seems like, you know, it appears the data is that vaccination may not prevent the prospect of long COVID. And there are people who have been given the new oral antiviral that so many are being prescribed now, Paxlovid. And despite that, there appears to be a significant burden of long COVID after that as well. So long COVID can encompass any number of symptoms, most common being extreme fatigue. You can have brain fog. Some people can have joint muscle pains. Myocarditis is not really one of those things. But some people that, you know, we've seen in our office can have reactivation of certain viruses like herpes simplex, cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus. And there's some people that think that the Epstein-Barr virus reactivation is a marker of long COVID. Those are some things that can be treated. Mm-hmm. Also, HHV6, human herpes virus number 6, that causes roseola. Almost every American has had it by the time they're 5 years of age. That's another virus that can reactivate after COVID. It's very similar wow. symptoms to a kind of chronic Lyme disease or what a lot of people suffer with Lyme. So I'm hoping that as we study this further, we'll have an answer for those Lyme sufferers.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. We'll take a few calls. If you want to get in, my guest today, Dr. Robert Tabali, giving you the latest on COVID, long COVID, and what could potentially be a new variant. How serious is it? Sarah's listening in Wausau, Wisconsin. Sarah, good afternoon.
Oh, hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have some family members who are in the medical field, and so I wanted to share when you started to talk about, are we seeing a resurgence? I always get worried when I don't want people to suddenly get afraid and start staying at home or avoiding their families again. Because I think we are seeing a resurgence. I, in fact, just recovered from the virus myself in the early part of the month. But it doesn't seem to be causing the same hospitalization. And so I think that's important to recognize. And perhaps we can celebrate that, you know, this virus is kind of hampering down into something less severe and less scary. Because, you know, I think we need to not live in such fear. And then my question for the doctor would be, it must be really difficult, and I don't know how the research happens, but there are so many things, it seems now, that cause these sort of chronic long-term problems. How do we sift through what's what? It seems like we have a lot of environmental exposures that are messing with our immune systems. We have a lot of autoimmune disorders, a lot of chronic fatigue and other chronic illnesses. How do we know that it's long COVID versus, you know, a slew of other possibilities? Is there actually like a blood test that tells us so, or are we just assuming?
Well, it's a bundle of good questions there. So I on your first point, I agree with you. I think that the COVID, the whole COVID situation, since most everybody in the country is either have some degree of immunity either from vaccination or a prior infection, I do think that as people get reinfected, and this is what we've seen here locally, is their symptoms are not nearly as bad. We have had a resurgence in infections across the country. We're up to about 110,000 known positive patients a day, and that's up from 14,000 to 15,000 back about 4 weeks ago. But there's a lot of people that we don't know that at this time that have COVID because, A, they're not getting tested in a lab that reports to the federal government. So those numbers are not accurate. What we've been seeing here locally is very similar to other places, is that the patients that are being admitted are not, you know, there are many people who are tragically ill still, but nowhere near what we saw in Delta and the initial wave of Omicron, likely because most of the people we're seeing now, at least in my facility, are mostly vaccinated, very elderly people, and their average age is like in the high 80s, low 90s. And they have been doing quite well, and these are people that have been fully vaccinated, maybe not boosted or not. But so long story short, I think it's very much COVID, but it's got a different impact than it used to be. The sledgehammer doesn't hit quite as hard as it did. You know, if you've never had it or you've never been vaccinated, you kind of want to consider, if the Novavax comes out, you don't like the messenger RNA vaccines, you might want to consider getting vaccinated with Novavax if they approve it on June 7th. Hopefully they will. Because if you've never had it, never been vaccinated, you know, you're still at risk for having severe illness from it. As far as the other stuff, there's no simple blood test. One paper put forth that they think that if your Epstein-Barr virus, certain nuclear antigens are elevated or you have recoverable virus in your bloodstream, that's a sign of long COVID. But most of the people that I see with long COVID symptoms don't have anything like that. It's just kind of an amorphous group of symptoms that you can't really prove. But the one thing that happened to lead them into the diagnosis of long COVID is they had COVID, and they had all the onset of these symptoms begin with their COVID infection.
Right.
Me personally, I fit the definition. I can't sleep for more than three and a half, four hours at a time anymore. I used to be able to sleep 8 or 9 hours, but that's my life right now.
I'm sorry to hear that.
The overwhelming fatigue.
That's torture. I don't get a lot of sleep.
I sleep during the day. You know, I take an hour nap in the middle of the day and stuff like this. I get through it. You learn to accommodate. But a lot of people have extreme fatigue. They can't concentrate on their work, and so their work and job performance is significantly impacted, which is a terrible thing for them.
You're no kidding. Doc, hold the thought. I'm going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll grab a few more calls. I only have about 10 minutes left with Dr. Tabali. If you are concerned, somebody you know right now is going through this new variant, maybe you're dealing with long COVID, Maybe you're waiting for that new vaccine. We'll answer your calls. We'll take your questions as we bring you up to speed on the latest. Stay with us. The conversation continues, and the chaplain will follow that.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Tell one friend about the Chaplet of Divine Mercy.
I'm not holding a small cup, Drew. I'm handing holding an extra large cup.
A bucket.
Every weekday at 4 Eastern, 1 Pacific on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we'll pray in about 10 minutes or so. Love to do that with you. And it's such a powerful time. I just feel God's presence so powerfully. And I certainly know He hears your prayers. If you're battling COVID, let's pray for you too. And that's what we're talking about right now. You're just getting plugged in. I was hoping, as I said a few minutes ago, COVID was behind us. And it seems that there is a new variant that is much faster in terms of the spread, its communicability. Is it more deadly? That's a big question. Probably not. I'm hoping as we see more of these variants, they become less lethal. And I hope we see less of them altogether. And Dr. Tabali, that's the big concern. In order for the virus to survive, it tends to be able to evade and survive, but as a result of it, it becomes less lethal. Is that correct? Or is there the possibility that this thing can turn dark and once again we could see masks and lockdowns and loss of life?
Well, I think the former is more likely. I mean, traditionally with these RNA viruses, they mutate to become more infectious but less lethal. You're absolutely correct. That's the most common experience. And so I and almost everybody else in the field thinks that that's what's going to happen with COVID. You know, that we'll continue to experience it just like the other four common coronaviruses that we will tell people, oh, I got a summer cold. We commonly get reinfected with those over and over and over again. But they are not lethal to most people. They just cause cold and cold symptoms, and hopefully that's what we'll be seeing on the COVID-19 evolve into. We're not there yet, yeah. But we're getting there.
Gotcha. All right, let's grab a few calls. You know how quickly time goes. Laura's been waiting. She's in Austin, Texas. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Drew. Hey, Doctor. So I have been dealing with chronic pain my whole life and haven't been able to really pinpoint it. But in searching, instead of increasing my meds, and this past January, February, March, April, May, I was extremely fatigued and thought I had a cold. So I went and got tested, and I tested negative. I've never tested positive, even though my whole family has had COVID. And searching for treatments for my chronic fatigue and pain, I came across ozone. And I also thought maybe I had Lyme disease. I grew up in Missouri. But I'm wondering if you have heard of ozone therapies. And I have been doing some treatments. I'm feeling really good today. So
good. All right, good. Doctor?
I really can't comment on ozone therapy. Some of the patients I see for Lyme disease go to alternative medicine practitioners. They take blood out of you, treat it with ozone, and then re-inject it back into you. It's not a standard therapy in medicine, and I personally, quite honestly, don't see the value in it. I can't really comment on it.
All right, great. Let's go to the next call. Thank you very much for your call, Laura. I appreciate your patience. Mary's listening in Evanston, Illinois. She's 83 years old. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Drew. Hello, doctor. Yeah, I'm just throwing this out there. I was 82 when I got the COVID, and I didn't get the vaccine because I have so many allergies. So my daughter and my granddaughter nursed me through. Then they got COVID. They handled it better. I'm left with 24/7 hours of headaches. I was already a migraine person, so I can't know which headache is which, you know. I had been diagnosed immediately in ER with DVT. So I have blood clotting issues that had I gotten the vaccine, I would have clotted, my vascular doctor said. So there's, and I'm tired, very tired, but I fight it constantly, and I pray a lot and offer all my pain up, of course. So, and my brother, who's a year older, he got COVID, and he's not, he's gave up. He just gave up. He didn't do anything for himself. So he's down to skin and bones, and he's just waiting to die. So there's different cases, you know?
So your advice, doctor, for Mary, 83 years old, didn't get vaxxed, 10 months of COVID, constantly tired.
Yeah, you know, I still favor people getting a check to see if they have reactivations of Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus, HHV6. These are common blood tests. They take 4 or 5 days to return, but if they are positive, I mean, they can be treated. Varicella zoster, the chickenpox virus, that can reactivate herpes simplex, same thing. But that's what I check in people. All the time. Unfortunately, a large percentage of people who get COVID can have clotting. Up to a third of patients that are admitted to the hospital and have oxygen requirements will get some type of blood clot within a couple of months after being discharged. That's why, I mean, aspirin, there's studies on both sides of the fence. I tend to favor it for people who've had COVID. Vitamin D3 continues to be very important for everybody to take. I personally recommend vitamin D3 at least 4,000 units a day and an aspirin a day. I think it's beneficial. There are studies that show that it's not. But, you know, having those viruses checked, unfortunately, you have to have a sympathetic ear and a doctor in order to have that done. But as I say, if they are elevated, they can be treated.
All right, let's move along. We'll go to Jane in Michigan. Some interesting questions. Jane, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. I'm wondering if I know that early one of the complaints with the COVID throughout this period of time has been early treatment wasn't offered. And so in my reading, I came across, you know, higher levels of D, zinc, quercetin, and even the use of ivermectin. So are they treating anybody with this variant with any of the early treatment protocols?
That's a good question.
Well, I mean, ivermectin is kind of more on the outside of approval. If you can imagine that, it could be more outside where they destroy doctors' careers for prescribing it. But there was a recent study that that allowed people to take ivermectin up to 7 days after onset of symptoms, which is kind of outside the window where it was always 3 days. But they showed that ivermectin was not helpful in that study. A lot of people think that was flawed. But ivermectin has become even more of a pariah medication in hierarchical organized medicine than it was previously. They're really, the only medicines that, you know, doctors can give other than, you know, people taking the vitamin D3, which is very helpful. People with normal levels of vitamin D actually survive COVID, survive heart attacks, survive ICU stays at a much higher rate than people with low levels of vitamin D. So that might be a lifelong lesson for all of us to take that. But the other things that you said are not really promoted in organized medicine. There's the Paxlovid, there's Molnupiravir for some people, but that's kind of the push where we're expected to go to prescribe for people. Yeah. Paxlovid is like 5 days.
Doctor, I didn't mean to step on you. We've only about a minute left. I wanted to follow up on something as you're going through some of these other remedies. Tilly, who was in Salt Lake City, Utah, was asking about something that Jane also had suggested quercetin. Are you familiar with that? A lot of people are recommending that for the treatment of COVID. What do you know about it?
Well, quercetin is thought to be an ionophore. It helps zinc get into cells. I'm not really a promoter of that. I've had a couple of people go into renal failure from it that were taking it on their own. They had other problems, but I don't really know enough about it to recommend it. But it's supposed to be used in conjunction with zinc. I mean, it's to let zinc into white blood cells and help infected cells. So it's a cofactor, not a direct agent.
Got it. Well, Doctor, I got to hold it right there. We're about to pray the chaplet. We'll certainly pray for you and Tamaki, your wife, and for your practice. Thank you for being here. Always good to talk with you. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you very much. God bless all.
God bless you. It's Dr. Robert Tabali. If you want to join me, I think there are two lines, maybe three lines now open at 888-914-9149. We'll pray the chaplet when I return. And we'll invoke the great mercy of God. If you have a need or an intention you can't get through on the phone lines for some reason, put them up at our Twitter page, @DrewMarianiShow, and Maggie will bring them to the prayer team.